I'm Marty Moscoane. Welcome to Radio Times. Chances are you work at a place that does diversity training. It's generally mandated with programs designed to reduce prejudice, misunderstandings, and the discrimination that can occur when working with people not like yourself, whether because of race, ethnicity, gender identity, sexual orientation, class, religion, country of origin, disability. It's a long list. Problem is, diversity training has a mixed record. It's not easy to change beliefs and stereotypes about other people. How do you persuade someone to change the way they think and behave without shaming them or hardening attitudes? How do employers create an environment where employees can be their authentic selves? This is not an easy task. The cosmetic chain Sephora shut down their stores a few weeks ago for an hour-long inclusion workshop after a racial profiling incident. But is an hour enough? Today on Radio Times, how do we make work more diverse and more inclusive? And we have three guests, two of whom join us here in our Philadelphia studio. Heath Fogg-Davis is director of the Gender, Sexuality, and Women's Studies Program, professor of political science at Temple University, also the author of Beyond Trans, Does Gender Matter? He's got a new e-workbook called Building Gender Inclusive Organizations. Heath Fogg-Davis, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. Also with us here in Philadelphia, Oscar Holmes IV. He's an associate professor of management at Rutgers University School of Business across the river in Camden. Oscar, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Great to be here.
Nice to have you with us. And joining us from France is Stephanie Creary. She is an assistant professor of management at the Wharton School of the University of Pennsylvania. And Stephanie Creary, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you so much for having me.
Let me just begin by saying we often do programs like this when there is a problem. We did a program after this Starbucks incident in Philadelphia. Sephora's had a program just a couple of weeks ago. And perhaps, Oscar, I'll begin with you. Does having these kind of diversity trainings when there is a problem, when something needs to be fixed, maybe someone needs to even be punished, does that send the wrong message about what diversity training is?
I think it does, because I think when we look at these issues, when we present diversity trainings, when a shock happens in the environment, like Starbucks or Sephora, we send the message that, you know, these issues weren't a problem before, like we were a perfect world before, and then, oh my God, we messed up, like something bad happened. So I definitely agree that it sends the wrong message, although I do think it is appropriate for these companies to actually engage in this type of activity, but just to not stop there. You know, a one-hour training is a good start, but it doesn't end there.
You know, Heath, I was listing all the diversities. I mean, these days, diversity is so diverse, is it not?
Yeah, it really is. And so this is a term that gets bandied about in our contemporary culture. And I think I'm so glad that we're having this conversation, because I think that there are several different definitions of the term. And so when I work with an organization or a company, the first thing that I do is I ask a series of questions. And the first one is, how do you and your organization define this term diversity, to try to understand? I think it can refer to a variety of things. For example, hiring and retention. You want your workforce to look different. It can also relate to relationships among employees and how they treat each other, or customer client facing kind of issues about your marketing even, and we've seen a lot of changes in our culture around that. I also ask them what they're already doing or what they've tried already, so that we know what we're building on, and also why now. And this gets to the comment that Oscar just made about, like, was it an incident that triggered this, or was it peer pressure from other organizations? Why now? And all of this is to get organizations to critically reflect on why they're doing it, because I don't believe that it's a one-size-fits-all approach, and that's often a misconception, that somebody can come in and fix the problem just by doing a training for an hour. And it's a much more reflective process about where you want to be and what your goals are.
Stephanie, let me get you in on the conversation, talking about diversity, but also talking about inclusion. You wrote some interesting articles and some interesting interviews in which you talk about that we all have these multiple identities, some of which we bring to the workplace, some of which we don't. Can you flesh that out for us?
Yes. So I think what's fascinating, the conversation that we were just having with Heath about having the several different definitions of diversity. In the U.S., historically, as we talked about diversity, it was race and gender, and that's bound up in some of the laws that were passed in the 60s in order to promote equal opportunity in the workplace. Interestingly, today, if you look at some of the new entrants to the workforce, we often refer to them as millennials or Gen Zers, their definitions of self are not bounded by single categories. They're bounded by thinking about what scholars Kimberly Crenshaw and others refer to as intersectionality. So it's not so much about being black or white or male or female. It's about the fact that I am a black woman or I'm a gay male, and I might also be somebody who's defined by those categories who comes from different social classes. And what is that experience of being both and multiple parts of me? How does that reflect my experiences in the workplace? So to get to the effectiveness of diversity training, some of the challenges that we're seeing is that it's not necessarily speaking to the ways in which people think about themselves, mm-hmm. particularly the people who think about themselves in multifaceted ways. So that's one reason that we're seeing why it's not all necessarily effective.
Well, let me pick up on a couple of things and even some very basic questions, and perhaps, Heath, I'll toss this back to you, which is then what is the goal? Is the goal to just that we just need to respect each other, and even if you don't agree with someone or you're uncomfortable with them or whatever, it's how you behave that really matters. Is that part of the goal, or is that the goal?
I think that that's a very amorphous kind of goal. We can't expect for companies and organizations to be steps ahead of where we are as a society, I think. Mm-hmm. And so what I really have focused on in my own work is various administrative policies. And I think we talked earlier just before we went on air about the Starbucks incident in Center City. That was a case where two black men were seated in Starbucks and they didn't have a visible purchase, but they were waiting for others to meet them, and the police were called and they were ejected. So that was touted as a case of racial profiling, which it was. To me, and Starbucks did this diversity training in response. To me, I would have wanted Starbucks to look at their policies concerning, customers who are in the store without a visible purchase, and like an amorphous kind of conception of that policy is really problematic. It gives the manager, in that case, the administrative leeway to make these judgments, which in my opinion, mm-hmm. they shouldn't have been put in that position in the first place. So the lack of a clear policy regarding the goals of the organization, I think that that's the real question, rather than the amorphous sort of like, we are the world, like, let's get along and be nice to each other. But what's relevant in terms of diversity to our specific goals as a business?
Let me put the same question to you, Oscar, about this notion about attitudes, even stereotypes, mm-hmm. even prejudicial right. thinking, and how we behave with each other.
I think it's important to take a both and approach, not either or. So I definitely think it is necessary for attitudes to change, because we do know that attitudes affect behavior. However, even if we had the most perfect types of programs to change attitudinal beliefs, values, we will still not rid our society from the numerous biases that many people face, many different groups face, because we also have a lot of structural issues of oppression, structural racism, structural sexism, patriarchy, and those things. So I think sometimes we are a little bit unfair, mm-hmm. When we look at the evidence to say, diversity training is not as effective, we should just scrap it. In fact, Edward Chang's and his co-author study, I thought that was a really positive outcome, the fact that even a one-hour online training.
This is the study that came
right,
from Penn.
Wharton, right. So just 1 hour doing online training, it did change some attitudes that people have. And particularly for the women, it made them advocate for themselves more. We didn't see the behavioral outcomes that we would want, like mentoring, but it was just an hour.
Right.
So I think diversity training itself gets a bad rap, but it's just only one tool. And I definitely think the time period should be a lot more than an hour. And I will also say, I don't think it's businesses alone who should carry the burden to fix all of these isms in our society. But in fact, they should be partnered with, universities and colleges and schools and governments, nonprofits. There's so many different organizations that we have to, together really try to wrestle with these issues.
Stephanie, let me go back to you and even ask you some very specific questions, because all three of you have talked about the importance, that really the value of this kind of diversity training or inclusive training, inclusive policies. But let's be specific. Is it a matter of people talking honestly with each other? Is it a matter of watching a video together or role playing? What seems to be effective?
So this is a great question. So some of my research that I'm working on currently, I'm actually interviewing chief diversity officers. It's actually been research that I've been conducting for the past 10 years, looking at the various strategies that organizational leaders engage in to manage diversity and inclusion, broadly speaking. And so I've asked quite a bit of questions about diversity training and education and what's the purpose of this. And what I've been fascinated with is in the past 10 years, particularly companies that have been engaging in diversity and inclusion management for some time, they're not focused on changing people's perceptions necessarily of other people for the sake of, you know, making us good humans. What they're interested in doing is raising awareness of the biases that we have and how those biases affect systems, right? So one example would be hiring. And another example would be promotion processes or performance evaluation. How is the biases that we have, conscious or unconscious, affecting the decisions that we make about who's the right person for the job, who's the right person to get the best performance evaluation possible? And so I think that's to say that there is a greater recognition, at least that I've seen from my research, that it cannot be the sole responsibility of organizations in a one-hour training or even a six-month training to rid people of biases that they've been developing since birth. And I think the ideas that Oscar and Heath have shared speak to that. These are deeply embedded belief systems that people have that are cultivated because of their educational system, their family unit, the communities that they belong to. So, of course, a one-hour training is not going to even begin to chip away at that. But can a one-hour training teach you how to monitor those biases so that they don't sort of poison the systems? Certainly, I think that's what some of the best companies are on the way to doing.
Looks like you want to respond. We're almost on a break here, but go ahead.
Yeah, I think that what Stephanie said is really interesting, and it makes me think about the issue of, just in general, I think that human beings don't respond well to being censored, and that's the perception that a lot of people have about diversity trainings. Just, you know, anecdotally, I've overheard people talking about the diversity trainings, you know, as an obligation that they resent, where people are recalcitrant. So I think that there's a sense in which we have to approach this in a proactive way that says this isn't about censoring you and your beliefs, but it is about making sure that in the business environment or the particular organization, that we're focused together on particular objectives, and, you know, how implicit biases interfere with those objectives is the main thing, not to change your religious perspectives or get you to think differently as a person to censor you, but to have you keyed in on the particular goals.
I want to pick up on that. That's Heath Fogg Davis, who joins us along with Oscar Holmes IV and Stephanie Creary. We are talking about diversity training, inclusivity at work. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne, talking with our guests about how to make work more diverse and more inclusive. And, of course, the workplace is much more diverse than it was a generation or even 10 or 20 years ago. Heath Fogg Davis, director of the Gender, Sexuality, Women's Studies Program and professor of political science at Temple University. Also with us, Oscar Holmes IV. He's an associate professor of management at Rutgers University School of Business in Camden. And out in France, we've got Stephanie Creary, assistant professor of management at the Wharton School of the University of Pennsylvania. And we do want you to join our conversation. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Stephanie, let me toss this to you, but I want to put this out for everyone to discuss. And Heath, you were talking about some people feeling as if they were targeted for their thinking, their prejudiced or even stereotype thinking. And in doing some research for the show, it seems that white males often feel in some of these diversity programs that, you know, that they're the problem, that they're the person that gets shamed, the bad guy. And I wonder to you, Stephanie, whether we're talking about ignorance or animosity or how we kind of fold all this together.
Yeah, so this is a great question. So certainly I think if you talk to any leader of a diversity program or human resource, they will say that if we had to categorize the group of individuals who are often less bought into corporate diversity inclusion practices and less satisfied with diversity training, it tends to be the white males. And so the question becomes, why is that the case? So certainly we have evidence to suggest that the level of awareness that exists on the with respect to the biases that other groups might face. You know, we can think about all these marginalized groups, from women to underrepresented racial minorities to people from LGBT communities, et cetera, that not having that experience or the exposure to those that lived reality makes it harder for them to understand why it might be the case that we need to engage in diversity training. So I think it's so that is definitely a fact. At the same time, the challenge is the discourse that we often have about who needs to be part of diversity training. It does target white males in a way that makes many white males feel uncomfortable because it suggests that they're the problem, and if they just got with the program, then we wouldn't have these issues when obviously, you know, we've already mentioned during this interview that the problem is not just individuals, it's systems that are created. So I think the reality is the more that we change the discourse from being about you are the problem to here's how you can help to be part of the solution. We do know that white males, on average, hold more positions of power. They do have the ability to affect change. So it's about them as change agents and not necessarily as people who need to be fixed as individuals. I think that that would go a long way to seeing more gains.
How do you see it, Oscar?
I agree a lot with what Stephanie just said, but I also want to just highlight the idea that I think as a society, we need to move away from the soft glove approach in terms of expecting that no one, particularly white men, won't feel discomfort when we discuss these issues. These are very emotional topics that have a real world consequence for many people. So when people go to the gym, you know, they obviously may experience some pain after they lift weights for a while. You know, and when we talk about these historical issues of oppression, it evokes a lot of pain. So I don't think, well, I definitely don't think we do ourselves any favors if we present a training or present a topic as you are the problem. However, I don't think the goal that any of us should, you know, try to foster in this environment would be we need to have soft gloves. We need to make sure white men do not feel uncomfortable. Because, in fact, discomfort is what all of us should experience when we talk about these issues. When you talk about racism, you talk about sexism, we should feel discomfort. You know, if we're not discomfort by, you know, some of these grave issues, then I think there's a problem. Something's going on with us.
Well, you raise an interesting point, and I guess the question is sort of how specifically then do you do this? And I mentioned, you know, is it ignorance? Is it animosity? I mean, what, you know, if someone has prejudicial ideas about another person, is that based on just they don't know better, or is it something more pernicious than that, Heath?
Yeah, I think that's that question, we might not be able to get to the answers of that. But I think it's really important that people in the leadership roles set the agenda for these things. And I really liked what Oscar just pointed out here, which is that this can't be you can't have significant or meaningful change without some degree of sacrifice or loss. And I think the shift even in the terminology, I mean, the reason why we started using the term diversity is because basically what the Supreme Court said about affirmative action and not being able in higher education, not being able to have quotas, and to move to this idea that diversity is a legitimate educational goal that you can pursue. And of course, the beneath that, of course, you have to have some kind of accounting system if you care about the, you know, the student body, what that looks like in terms of diversity, and the same thing with organizations. So for me, I think to have a frank conversation with leadership around those issues, like what do you want to see your workforce look like? Do you want to see it reflect the community that you're in terms of race and gender and other identities, or do you want to be ahead of the curve and do something that's innovative and trailblazing?
I mean, Stephanie, this I mean, the question, it seems to me the goal of inclusion and diversity is to help people understand each other better, to have some more acceptance. But I could understand if you are that person who, in a sense, is being targeted, or as Oscar says, we want you to be uncomfortable, that could harden someone's attitude. How do we address that?
Yes. So I think there's a difference between what we would love to see in an ideal world and what actually happens in practice. So an ideal world, I think many of us would love to see that we were all on the same page in understanding the unique disadvantages that certain groups have had relative to others, combined with the unique advantage that other groups have had, and how recognizing those would make it easier for us to understand one another across our differences, et cetera, and so forth. But in reality, people are emotional beings and can be quite defensive, particularly when it comes to topics related to diversity. And so there have been, in organizations today, many strategies put in place as a way of not starting with the topics that make people most defensive, and then using that as an opportunity. So how do you get in and establish a conversation with somebody about diversity who feels defensive, and then how do you work your way over time to addressing some of the more complicated issues, I think is where we're seeing the success. So rightfully or wrongfully, a conversation about the business case for diversity has worked in many cases because it feels unemotional to people who feel like diversity would be targeting them inadvertently. But it has downstream consequences, because when you hide behind a conversation about diversity that's only about innovation and creativity, you begin to further marginalize the issues that people who are underrepresented experience. So does that give us an in to change, to create a narrative around innovation and creativity? Yes. Is it true that diversity of thought can help us to be more creative and innovative? Yes. But is that really the end goal? And so this sort of brings me back to a point I believe Oscar made earlier about, I think it's really important to define the end goal. Are we just trying to be creative and innovative? Well, then a narrative around the business case for diversity makes sense. Are we actually trying to create equity in our organizations? Well, then we need to talk about some of the hard, tough, emotional topics and have honest conversations across our differences. But to use Oscar's words, the both hand, and are we trying to do both? If we're trying to do both, we need to create interventions that actually are trying to get us both to equity and to creativity.
And that's Stephanie Creary. She's Assistant Professor of Management at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. Oscar Holmes, the fourth, Associate Professor of Management at Rutgers University School of Business across the river in Camden. And Heath Fogg Davis, Director of the Gender, Sexuality, and Women's Studies Program, also Professor of Political Science at Temple University, talking about diversity training. And again, you can join us, 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Heath, let me turn back to you, and I'll just say some personal things. In the last couple of years, interviewing people who want to go by the pronoun they. Mm-hmm. And I think we're in a really interesting time related to gender identity and sexual orientation and what people call themselves. Mm-hmm. And in interviewing these people, I have stumbled. I have used the wrong pronoun. You know, I didn't intend it. Mm-hmm. I was trying to do a really good job, but I screwed up, to be perfectly honest with you. And then we had a bit of a conversation about it, but I'm sure that was offensive to those people. How do we struggle with this?
Yeah, I'm glad that you brought that up. I think that you create room for forgiveness, and I'll share just very quickly my own personal anecdote about this. So having transitioned from female to male at the age of 38, you know, the best piece of advice that I got from a colleague who was had transitioned earlier was that this idea that people don't want to be wrong, and the biggest obstacle that you're going to face is that people don't know what to do. They don't know what to say. And the best thing to do is to kind of get out in front of that. And so I crafted a memo, essentially, that I sent to my colleagues to say, you know, here's what's happening. Here's the pronoun that I'll be using. You can screw up. It's okay. You know, it'll take time.
That.
Yes, because that's very, very important. Because ultimately my goal was not to alienate my colleagues, but to make, you know, consistently be a part of a team to accomplish similar goals. So I think that that's really important. And I feel like just sort of I became my own little company organization, having my own administrative policies, just to lay them out to say, here's what's going on, and let people know what to do or say. And that's a similar kind of obstacle in diversity training. People get recalcitrant because they feel like, you know, they don't know what to do. And with the pronoun issue, I'm not going to get it right, and what's going to happen? I'll be embarrassed. The person will be upset with me. All of these things, getting back to Stephanie's point about emotionality, to try to deal with some of that, I think you can set out some policies.
Well, and I'm wondering, you're nodding your head, Oscar. Looks like you want to add something. Did you want to add something?
Yeah, I agree with what Heath said. And, you know, we have to realize that all of us make cultural faux pas, what I call cultural faux pas. Even as a diversity researcher myself, I made them. And in fact, anytime I go into an organization and do a training on diversity, I begin with some of the cultural faux pas that I've made. So it's this is never a destination. No one is ever going to become bias-free in their lifetime, right? We all have these types of conscious or unconscious biases. The best thing we can do is build awareness and build knowledge so that we can make fewer mistakes along the way. And for the most part, I think many people of marginalized identities, we are really forgiving, you know, particularly in a situation where, you know, you were trying to do the right thing. Mm-hmm. You know, you just had a slip up. In that case, I think, you know, most people are really forgiven of those type of you know, mishaps or culture faux pas. And it's the intent behind a lot of the actions that will really make someone feel offended.
Stephanie, let me go back to you, and then we'll get some of the callers and commenters in on the conversation. But I'm wondering, in some of these trainings, whether we learn things about our coworkers that may make us uncomfortable, or, you know, just how, I guess, how revealing, how authentic can we be? Do we want to be in the workplace?
Yes. So I love this question, because I actually believe that there's quite a divide in terms of people's willingness to disclose information about themselves that would make them feel vulnerable, and their willingness to listen to information about other people that would make them feel vulnerable. We actually know from research that people who are racial and ethnic minorities or who are LGBT are less likely to want to disclose personal information or information that somehow might make them vulnerable in the workplace. Why? Because we have a history of using that information to further marginalize people, right? So that task of doing so might be one that might be a little bit more difficult for somebody who comes from an underrepresented group. I think at the same time, it's important for us as individuals who work together to understand the experiences that we each have, particularly in terms of how it affects our ability to be the workers that we need to be. Mm. So we do not leave ourselves at the door, contrary to popular belief. We actually bring ourselves in. So I think there's a balancing act around how much is enough and how much is too much that we're constantly trying to strike. And I would say that that's sort of the going paradigm right now that organizations are trying to tackle when it comes to how authentic can you be and should you be in the workplace.
Let me get Ebony from, looks like, New Jersey to join our conversation. And Ebony, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty. It's so nice to hear you're bringing up these fantastic topics. Great. I just want to throw out something that will make everyone there a little uncomfortable, and I apologize in advance, okay? The distress and the tone of these kinds of conversations, and I know you all mean well, but it's missing an opportunity to stress that diversity celebrates an incredible, you know, variety of cultures, and those cultures are actually more powerful than the policy wonks and the business managers and the management theorists. Culture is more powerful than money. And yet we stress the money and power, and everybody gets anxious and wrings their hands. And the truth is, bring in some artists, pay them as much as you would pay a manager, and have them teach jam sessions. Bring in Black culture, bring in Chinese culture, Buddhism. You know, there are marginalized white cultures like the Quakers you could bring in here. There's so much interesting, beautiful features of humanity and nature. Bring in a little nature because they're it's marginalized. But man,
Ebony, I'm going to jump in here only because
you're doing.
Yeah, I appreciate it. I think what you're telling us is we should be celebrating diversity. I'm looking at you, Heath, rather than sort of wringing our hands over the fact that we're not doing it as well as we could.
Yeah, and I think this kind of goes back to where we started this conversation about, which is that diversity means a lot of different things to different people, and we can't, you know, we're focused here on diversity trainings within organizations and what the limits of that are. And I think that, you know, we've talked a little bit about what the limits are. It's, you know, I don't think that you can do everything. I think, you know, we just recently had LGBTQ Pride in Philadelphia, and I noticed in the parade there were even more so than ever various companies and organizations that had floats, and were so that kind of like participation is one thing. It doesn't really get to the substance of cultural difference and identity differences. So I think that Ebony makes a very good point. It's very hard to do. It doesn't mean that we shouldn't give up on it. But I do think that keeping people focused on particular goals is important.
Right. But what I hear her saying is that this is a good thing. You want to live and work in a diverse environment.
Yes, yes, I agree. Diversity is a good thing. You know, Stephanie brought up the business case for diversity earlier, and I understand the reasons why, you know, organizations like to start off with that case. I like to say that we need to stop using the business case for diversity because I think it put an insurmountable onus on the most marginalized people, i.e. the business case being diversity brings this, you know, increased productivity. Well, what if you do have a diverse group and you mm-hmm. have negative performance? You know, what are the outcomes? What should you tell, you know, the top leaders of the organization? You know, should we lay off all these people who come from marginalized identities? You know, I don't think that's the answer that we want either. And in fact, we know from at least the scientific research, you know, there's a lot of negative studies, you know, that have shown, you know, diversity led to, you know, negative outcomes, whereas there's others that's positive. So we know you really need to take a nuanced approach when we look at diversity. It's not just getting the people there, but it's also the types of environments that, you know, managers foster in their companies.
We're going to take another short break and get back to our conversation. That's Oscar Holmes IV. He's an associate professor of management, Rutgers University School of Business in Camden. Stephanie Creery, assistant professor of management at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. Heath Fogg Davis, director of the Gender, Sexuality, and Women's Studies program at Temple University. Much more after this short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with our guests about the fact that many workplaces either mandate or offer diversity training, but unfortunately the track record on whether it leads to greater understanding is mixed, if not downright poor, especially if it's a one-day intervention. We're talking about how to change attitudes, beliefs, and stereotypes about coworkers. Can you be your authentic self at work? You can call us 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Stephanie, a question from Peter. What do your guests think about having a trained mediator on staff and workplaces to address some of the day-to-day issues around diversity? Seem like a good idea?
Yeah, what originally popped to my mind when I heard that question was, well, there are diversity consultants, right, who effectively are supposed to be playing that role. I think the reality is, and so this comes back to a point that the last caller was making about, you know, we're talking so much about the problematic sides of diversity. Why don't we talk about some of the things that we want to do, like in the affirmative, a much more positive orientation? So I think one of the challenges is that oftentimes diversity training is about don't do the bad thing, right? But in some recent research that my colleagues and I at Wharton are developing, we see that companies, especially some of the most forward-thinking ones, are engaging in lots of different types of practices. Education is one of six buckets that we unearth, and the strategy that certainly that Ebony put out there around celebrating difference is in a different bucket, right? This is some of this more of this affirmative language around diversity and inclusion and what good it can do. That's actually where we see a lot of diversity consultants or these trained mediators, if you will, playing a role, is not just telling us what you don't want us to do, which is oftentimes what diversity training does,
right,
but teaching us how you actually want us to behave. And that's in some of these other things, like how should we effectively assess somebody's application in our organizations? How can we be better mentors? How should we effectively share our stories about our positive and our negative experiences with our colleagues? That's where I see some of these mediators playing an effective role in the form of diversity consultants.
Let me read a comment from Shay saying, I think the reason a lot of white men feel defensive about diversity training is that some don't feel particularly privileged, especially if they came from poor neighborhoods. And I think we don't want to fall into the trap of stereotyping all these different diverse groups of people, that within certain groups, there is also a lot of diversity.
Absolutely. And this kind of gets back to a point that the previous caller made that I wanted to circle back to, which is, we have to be careful that we're not essentializing culture at the same time. So, you know, the caller mentioned black culture as an example. So black culture is very diverse, and there's a lot going on there. And so often, I mean, the downside of trying to present, like, all, it's a multicultural kind of approach to things where you just sort of, like, I don't know, like Black History Month, you have like an event that just celebrates Black history, and then Women's History Month, you have that, you know, that kind of compartmentalization, I think, can be problematic as well. But also, I think that we have to differentiate between the principle of non-discrimination and diversity. So, and I think that Stephanie was talking about this. So when I was sort of talking to my friends just about coming to do the show today, I asked them about diversity trainings that they had participated in.
Right.
And often people had a hard time. They conflated the compliance training videos that compliance with Title VII or Title IX around sexual harassment, presenting you with various scenarios. Is this sexual harassment? Is it not? Versus diversity trainings, which were part of the study that we were talking about earlier, which are much more proactive and talk about diversity in different ways. So I think making clear that distinction is good as well.
I mean, it seems, Oscar, we're talking about relationships, and we're talking about right. how we relate to one another,
right.
working in a close environment.
Right. So, you know, when I go into organizations or with my students or different clients, I use a privilege activity so people can actually quantify where they fall on an axis of privilege. So part of, I think, what the commenter mentioned, Shay mentioned, could be perhaps this idea of just raising awareness, because if you are a fish, you don't know that you're in water, right? So what we're saying a lot when we talk about these, again, systematic issues, is that no one is saying that white people don't have issues or white people struggle. It's just the struggles and issues are not because of their race, whereas you have other marginalized identities that they have specific issues and struggles because of that identity. So part of that, and I think what this activity does, it actually gets people moving around. Mm-hmm. And when they start answering questions, they begin to see how their identity actually affords them different privileges that are systematic. And I think that's the big issue that a lot of diversity trainings and a lot of the consultants that come into organizations want people to see. It's not just you as an individual, but it's a system that we live in. And that is hopefully the system that we're trying to change.
And Stephanie, that gets us to this issue about class. You know, I don't think anyone knows how to talk about class in this country or perhaps even another country as well. Do you have some thoughts on that?
I definitely do. I think all of us here today represent organizations or educational institutions that are devoting more resources to actually understanding social class, particularly in the academic sector, but we're also seeing it spill over into organizations. So we talk about first-generation low income, and those aren't necessarily the same thing. So being a first-generation college student, what's your experience like versus somebody whose parents have, you have generations of people who've gotten college degrees, and then being low income. And that's certainly a dimension of difference as we sort of revert to the earlier conversation about multiple identities and intersectionality. And certainly the caller's concern about thinking about white men as privileged in all ways and perhaps not differentiating those who have had resources versus those who haven't. I think we're in an interesting time where we're starting to tackle these questions, but I think to get at some of the heart of what Oscar is saying is what becomes important is to understand that Whereas I think we can relate to one another based on having had different marginal experiences, it's important to also recognize the power of having had privilege and how that affects other people's experiences. I think the last point that I want to make is to suggest that I think there's an opportunity to understand this diversity conversation both as something that supports the needs of individuals, particularly along the themes of understanding the experiences that we all have, our capacity to build effective relationships across work, and to work in an environment that feels fair and free of discrimination. I think that is definitely a conversation that has waxed and waned, but it's increasingly important, particularly in the societal context, to not lose. But I do also believe that there is an opportunity to understand how, in treating people well, in helping people to gain opportunity, that actually supports the collective. And in this case, the collective that we're often talking about is the organization. Now, we all represent business schools, so
nice.
That's sort of what our...
Not me.
Our
actually, not Heath, but yeah, close.
We can also talk about educational institutions or government as
gotcha.
Well.
Well, which gets to, I think, a question I want to ask. It's just very specific in a sort of one-to-one relationship. If someone says something that is offensive or racist or sexist or all the stereotypes that we have, and I'll put this first to you, Heath, how do we handle that? What, you know, not, it's not a diversity training. It's, you know, you're sitting next to your coworker and they say something absolutely outrageous.
Yeah, I mean, you're getting down to the nitty-gritty
about
what this actually looks like. I mean, I do think that it helps within an organization to have policies about what should happen when that happens. But just as, you know, a human being, I mean, I think that you can, you know, call people out on that. You should, but in a way that maybe is productive rather mm-hmm. than just, I don't believe in just sort of like getting rid of people when they make one mistake, you know, around these issues. And we talked about, even for those of us who are doing this work, I've definitely made mistakes. I mean, well, that's different, you know, from the offensive comments necessarily, but it's on a continuum. Mm-hmm. So I think apologizing and moving on is the best kind of approach to that.
How do you see it, Austin?
I definitely agree with Heath. I think the reactions that organizations take need to be analogous to what the offense was. So there's a continuum of offenses that people can have. Approach that many people suggest, first of all, this is a very difficult question to answer because there are so many different variables that people need to consider. Like, is this person a leader and I'm a subordinate? Like, you know,
do they do this all the time?
Right. Is it in public? You know, so there's no one best answer. Mm-hmm. But approach can be, you know, what's your observation? You know, like I observed that, you know, you said something that was offensive to people. Mm-hmm. Asking people to follow up, you know, it sounded like you said this. Did you really mean? Mm-hmm. You know, to say this, or mm-hmm. you know, why would you say something like this? Because I don't think, you know, this is the type of environment that we want to set, you know, as an example. So giving people an opportunity to really clarify if they really said what you thought you heard or what you thought you said, and then how did it make you feel? You know, when you said this comment, it made me feel like you didn't value people like me. Mm-hmm. And then what's your desire at the end of it? You know, in order for us to have a productive working relationship, I would like it if you could refrain from using types of slurs like that or saying things like that. So it's like an observe, feel, think, desire framework that we kind of advise a lot of people to use sometimes.
Say those words again. Observe.
Observe, feel, think, desire.
Okay.
You know, what's your observation? How did it make you feel? What do you think the person meant by it? And then what's your desire? Like, what do you want to see going forward?
Stephanie, anything you want to add to that?
The only thing that I want to add is, you know, we're looking at the larger issue around how do people address one another, what's offensive. I think it's important to talk about organization values. Organizations set the tone. And I think it's important for when we're examining the comments that people make, the ways that they engage, that we assess are these aligned or not with our values. I think there is a drastic step that's often taken, which is sort of we try to get rid of the person who has said something offensive. And sometimes the issue is so egregious that that's warranted, but sometimes I think there is a way to jump into some of these strategies that Oscar and Heath are suggesting that would be the first line of defense rather than just kicking them out altogether.
Let me read a couple of more comments. One from Lauren. She says, I have two teenage boys who are always talking about whether their friends are racist. I'm trying to teach them about implicit bias instead to nuance the conversation. I think we should talk to kids more about implicit bias. Heath, do you agree with that?
I think it's a...
And this is the kind of bias that is sort of deep-seated, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's the conversation around implicit bias is important. However, I would, not to be too cynical, but I would also point out that it has become kind of a buzzword, and there are a lot of buzzwords attached to what we're talking about here today. And what's interesting, sort of just conceptually, is to trace the history of the terminology that we've used over time. And it's not clear to me that we're really talking about something completely new now, but it's a different way of talking about it. And the problem becomes when the buzzword is so pervasive in the culture that everybody thinks they know what it means, but nobody really understands anymore. A similar, you know, with the term intersectionality that mm-hmm. Stephanie brought up earlier, very important, but also has lost a lot of its intrinsic meaning because of the pervasive usage of it.
An email from Dave who says, there's no need to be your whole self at work. Work life and home life are fundamentally different and should be treated as such. Stephanie, do you agree?
Yeah, that's what I mean by sort of one of these interesting topics. My colleague, Nancy Rothbard at Wharton, she does research on like people who tend to integrate, basically bring themselves to the same situation everywhere they go, and people who tend to compartmentalize or segment. And so that caller is certainly has a preference, and we know people have preferences for segmentation. The reality is when segmenters meet integrators. So what happens, so I got a great example for you here, is certainly all of the conflict that we've seen in our larger society and how that's spilling over into workplaces. So, for example, a few years back when there were many more frequent or at least on the media experiences of unarmed African-American men being, shot or assaulted in some way by police officers, that was actually spilling over into many workplaces. And Goldman Sachs is one company that decided to open up a larger conversation around race in America in ways that had many benefits, I think, from a well-being perspective, but also from a relational perspective for their employees. So as much as we might say we can keep ourselves out, there are certainly instances, and I think particularly for people who are feeling marginalized, that it's not really possible to do that. That, to me, I think, speaks of the privilege that some people might have to distance and the lack of privilege that others might have.
Let me squeeze in a tweet before we have to say goodbye. Oscar, I'll toss this to you. A tweet from Nathan who says, how do you effectively respond to those who say that merit, M-E-R-I-T, is more important than anything else?
So, you know, we have the whole meritocracy myth and this idea that, you know, you get what you deserve. And we know from all of the scientific research that it is just that. It's a myth. And, you know, we don't live in a just world,
right?
We don't live in a fair society. We don't live in a meritocratic society. What I am trying to do to dispel some of those issues is changing the narrative in terms of, like, how we hire people. Because a common idea that people have is you should just hire the best person for the job. And that in itself is just a false myth as well. We don't need the best person for the job. In fact, in many instances, the quote-unquote best person may not be the person we want anyway. That person may cost too much, right? They may require a higher salary. We just need a qualified person for the job. And when you get into that conversation, then you open up the applicant pool a lot broader to say, okay, from this pool, we have a lot of qualified people who can do this job. Yes, this person may have gone to Harvard, and this person may have gone to a state school that's far less ranked on paper, quote unquote, the person from Harvard may be considered the quote unquote best, but we don't need the best for all the jobs. We just need a qualified person. And if you have a qualified person, you're doing well, because we all know there's many cases where people don't even hire qualified people for jobs.
That's a whole other
right, that's another
topic
conversation.
For a different show.
So I think that changing the narrative about right. who we hire can actually be of great benefit for diversity inclusion, because we open up more and more doors. And we know merit in itself, that's based on systems of oppression as well. So,
well, we're going to leave it there. Oscar Holmes IV, thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
Associate Professor of Management at Rutgers University School of Business in Camden. Heath Fogg Davis, thank you for coming in as well. Director of the Gender, Sexuality, and Women's Studies Program, also Professor of Political Science at Temple University. He has a new e-workbook called Building Gender Inclusive Organizations. Stephanie Creary, thank you for joining us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Assistant Professor of Management at the Wharton School of the University of Pennsylvania. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Bilder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us.